Welcome to the Marxist School of Sacramento. Thanks for coming out tonight. We're having a panel discussion tonight on the unholy marriage of the internet and capitalism. But before I go any further, please mute or turn off your cell phone. I'm leading by example. Ellen just asked me to remind you that we have organic cookies and mostly organic corn chips, okay? Plus a regular offering of tea and coffee. Mike Manaski is going... Oh, the coffee's organic too, okay. Mike Manaski is going to set the table for us tonight and touch on the high points of the article from the March 2011 monthly review. It's online if you don't have a subscription copy. And then we're very happy to have as well two of our esteemed local journalists, Dan Bacher, who's the editor of the Fish Sniffer, and he also writes for Alternate, Counterpunch, and a number of other publications. And Dan Garrity is the back here of the two Dans. He runs the website elkgrovenews.net, which covers all things local and Elk Grove. And without any further ado, we're going to follow our usual program tonight of an hour for the presentation, in this case a panel discussion, followed by a break, lock the doors, draw out our long knives, go for the big dollars, and then we'll have a Q&A to wrap up the evening. So without any further ado, Mike Manaski, the unholy marriage of the internet and capitalism.
Thank you. Take it away, Mike. Thank you, Seth. This is a real treat for me to be able to do a presentation. This is now the 13th year of the Marxist School, so it's kind of exciting. And this is the final point of view series lecture event that we have. We have one each month. And so far we have, I guess, about 130 of these, 100 or so presentations like this. In addition, we also have book discussions most of you are familiar with twice a month. I think the computer finally died. And it's okay. The article is from the Monthly Review, as Seth mentioned.
Hey, Mike.
Yes.
Since you're speaking this time, and you know, this is rare for you, kind of give a biographical background on yourself, you know, and how
on
you
me?
Got,
oh.
Yeah. Seriously.
Well, the longest, yeah, the reason why I've been long-lived with this group is because I used to shoot this for video for community TV. So I did that for about 5 years, actually from 98 to 2003. This organization incorporated in 2000 through John Rountree's efforts, who's now in Ann Arbor with his wife, Professor Mary Schlettelbrau, and at the University of Michigan, which, by the way, is your Dan Garrity's alma mater. But my interest in this has been in Marxism has been a cult. I didn't realize I was being weaned until a high school religion teacher had us read Eric Fromm's The Art of Loving. And in reading that, we were given an historical materialistic view to analyze a worldview. And so I tracked back to that, the age, whatever age I was, 14 or 15, the tender age, you know, a kid unsuspecting but realizing that this was an analysis of the human condition. Here we're talking about marriage, my first question and ongoing question until today, what I actually discovered kind of a connection on the love affair and why they refer to this as an unholy marriage is interesting. But let me get to some of these screens, because it's really an interesting article that was written by these two luminaries, really. We've had John Bellamy Foster here at the school once before. I was unfortunately out of town at the time, and so I wasn't able to see him speak. But he is one of the editors of the Monthly Review and teaches at the University of Oregon, if I'm correct. And I believe he is a... Is he a sociologist? Okay. And I'm getting nods. And then the other writer is Robert McChesney from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, who is a communications professor there. My preliminary remarks will go over use value, exchange value, the Lauderdale paradox, some myths about the media, and then finally some legislation, a little bit of that, just for preliminary stuff. Use value is talked about by many of the great classic economists, but I'll distill it in one page. It's a constituent of wealth, according to Marx. It depends upon the actual consumption of an actual object. It is not dependent upon commodity, but it is a necessary prerequisite to commodity. And it's also an expression of social need, but not an expression of social relations. If I go to the next slide, I will explain it a little bit. It's different from exchange value insofar as it defines not the actual physical object and its use, but rather its form of appearance, or the Erscheinung uns Form, the German for the form of appearance of value itself. So that's what exchange value is. It's a little more it's less concrete than use value. It depends upon a commodity status in a market setting where things are exchanged. So if you don't have a commodity, or if this thing is just a tree and it's not board feet of lumber, then you don't have commodity status. If there is no market in which this thing is exchanged, like the carbon dioxide being sequestered by the tree or the oxygen being put off by the tree, then that thing is not... it has no exchange value. So the shade of the tree, the oxygen and carbon dioxide exchange of the tree has no exchange value. Those are use values. It depends upon the exchange value. It depends also upon how much Arbeitskraft or the labor force that's needed. And we had some discussions about this when we were talking about the propensity of profit rates to fall. And it's because capital depends very much on the value of labor. So when we look at labor, the amount of labor that's needed to compared from product to product to make a commodity, that's what gives value to an item. And then finally, exchange value as opposed to use value expresses and contains social relations, so that the relation... When you look at a use value of a diamond, as explained by Marx, you don't know whether the diamond was mined by a worker who was paid a good wage or a slave. Whereas in exchange value, you do know, because you know of whence it came. So that's the difference in use and exchange values. David Ricardo, an 18th century economist, and a predecessor of Marx, promoted the distinction between use and exchange value. And he argued if water or some other natural resource formerly or and freely available acquired an exchange value due to the growth of its scarcity, so that in the case of water, it was a drought, and therefore people had to buy it, there would be an actual loss of wealth, that is, use value, reflecting the loss of use values, despite the increase of the private riches, let's say, of the water company. In the Lauderdale paradox, which I'll talk about later, I'll just describe it. It's the reverse or inverse correlation between public wealth, which is the use value, and the private riches, which is based on the exchange value. So the question that the authors ask is, in this article, is should the internet be within or outside the domain of capitalism? And then finally, does creation of scarcity establish and promote the individuation and concentration of wealth? So it's just two ways of saying kind of the same thing. They also discuss a myth about the media, and what I came up with today as the kind of the internet as capital's KY jelly in its unholy marriage with capital between them. And that is this term called friction-free capitalism, where the internet unleashes entrepreneurs, slays monopolies, promotes innovation, and so on, according to Bill Gates in his book, 1995 book, The Road Ahead. Of course, this was 5 years before the collapse of the internet and the dot-com bust. And the all of that is fiction, that there are so many entrepreneurs, number one, in fact, we've seen concentrations of wealth, that those monopolies have actually occurred as a result of the efforts of people like Bill Gates. And that innovation, really, most of the patents and copyrights are being bought up by even larger corporations single-mindedly for that purpose. And then another issue that's brought up is the deregulation that was triggered by the legislation in the Telecommunications Act of 1996, which was the first time in over 60 years. Back in 1934 was the last time there was a major Telecommunications Act like this, and it allowed media cross-ownership. So if I own 10 radio stations, I can now buy 10 newspapers. Or if I own, you know, if I'm an internet entrepreneur and I made a lot of money, I can now buy radio stations, and so on. So, and that was Bill Clinton who did that for us. So that's kind of an interesting thing. And then when we look at the, unfortunately we have a light up there, but that's the big six up there. The media outlets include General Electric, Walt Disney, News Corp. News Corp, of course, being Fox, and all of those are enumerated. And when you look at the revenues, just for this is from 2009, 3 years ago, GE had from their just their media outlets. That's all, not including making nuclear submarine engines or all the other stuff that they make. $157 billion in revenues from just from the media interests of General Electric. Walt Disney, $36 billion. News Corp, $30 billion. Go to the next one. Time Warner, which is touted as being the largest conglomerate of media in the world, at $25.8 billion. Viacom, $13.6 billion, and CBS at $13 billion. If you add all that up, it's about $0.25 trillion in revenues for that 1 year. $0.25 trillion. And that's just media. So, where does that leave us? Well, the writers of this article decided to focus on the effects of internet service providers, okay, on the internet. How did they create, or what effects have they created on the internet? And there are three areas: corporate control, market concentration, and then the deformation of information as a public good. Under corporate control, the ISP is defined as the telephone and cable monoliths that got government monopolies. And the authors refer to these ISPs, these internet service providers, as the poster children of crony capitalism. I don't know if any of you have ever been to the Sacramento Metro Cable Community Cable Foundation meetings here in Sacramento. Actually, it's the they get the money from it's a government agency that's appointed or that sends elected officials to oversee the cable contracts. And it's really interesting to go to those meetings because they'll dicker over really idiotically banal things like the public. The three, so-called three-legged stool of public access, which is public access TV, educational TV, and government TV. And yet most of the money is being, they only get a few percent of all the profits, that go directly to these huge government, in these huge monopolies, you know, like Comcast. And to illustrate that, households within the monopoly market of one ISP across the United States is nearly one in five. Households with a monopoly market of two ISPs is nearly four in five. So there's no real competition between these ISPs, and the lack of competition drove these ISPs, according to the authors, to compete together to raise prices and degrade networks. We would call that not competition, but, you know, getting together and plotting that, you know, make a lot of money on their own. And that's exactly what I've seen happen in my experience of having gone to the cable hearings. And most of the time, there are, it's attorneys battling over. You know, there's usually a counsel for the cable companies, and there's counsel for the government agency that oversees it. And there, I see collusion there myself. But, and that's what this article lays claim to as well. The second area of the effects of internet service providers on the internet is market concentration. Google holds over 70% of the search engine market. This is as of last year in their study. The actual hardware that's found in this computer and our cell phones and everything else, they're calling it a corporate duopoly. That Wi-Fi chipset is manufactured by only two companies. And they control 80% of that market. So there's extreme concentration. So not only is there control, as we saw in the other slides of the Big Six, by corporations, but that corporate control is very concentrated. In iTunes, they control 87% of digital music downloads. Apple controls 73% of the MP3 player market. The codec, which is the software, as far as I can figure out what a codec is anyway, it's that's used in the video market. MPEG LA Group, that company, controls two-thirds of that video market with that one piece of software. Yeah.
Right. iTunes is Apple, correct?
Yeah. Yeah, but that's just the music downloads. That's
and
the downloads.
The MP3 player is the iPod.
And then the Apple control of the MP3 player is the iPod. Precisely. Thank you. So we're talking about a variety of software and hardware that demonstrates the concentration of these markets. In the first case, the search engine is obviously hardware and software. The chipset is hardware, the iTunes is a hardware, or is software, the MP3 player is hardware, the codec is software. And so those are all different products, soft and hard, that are controlled and concentrated by corporations. There is an effort to try to define the size of a market and its value, and that's what Metcalfe's law is. It shows that the exchange value, so that market value, of a network increases by a square of the number of connections. So, for example, if I'm an ISP, an internet service provider, and I provide services to the equivalent of 10 communities, and then I expand by buying your 10 communities, bringing them on board, then my network has doubled in size, but the value has quadrupled. Okay, something like that, yeah. Metcalfe's law says that we're holding that to the, or we're squaring that value. Okay.
It's a gazillion.
Hmm?
It's a gazillion. It's a square.
Okay.
It's
No. But if you go from 10 to 20, you've doubled it. So n is 2, squared is 4. The other way to describe it is to look at... I'm a respiratory therapist, so if you suddenly stop breathing, and I know that you're... trachea is exactly no. Listen, if your trachea is about 3/4 of an inch across, right? And I take something and I reduce it down to 1/3 that size, okay? Because I put a tube in there and I start blowing stuff through, your ability to breathe is going to be very much compromised, okay?
Does the trachea choke me if I keep it working?
If I take the yes, exactly. And if I take that tube out, you'll have 3 times the what I gave you before, right? Well, instead of giving you 3 times as much airflow, I'm giving you 9 times as much airflow because it's square.
The number of connections is 10 of the 100.
Yeah. No, the square. No, the square of the comparison of the number of connections.
Oh.
Yeah. I. Yeah. It's PowerPoint. So.
But why?
Why? Is that an actual
one? Why?
And let me go through Reed's law, and then it'll say, and why is will come up. Reed's law says that instead of being n squared, it's 2 to that n power. So that the exchange value increases as the exponent to the base 2. And as you know, in base 2, things do become progressively, there is a geometric progression, but it's always being multiplied by 2. It's kind of like chicken heart. When chicken heart takes over 1/4 of the world, you know, the next day it'll double again and takes over half of the world, and then the next day what happens? It takes over the entire world. So that's what Reed's law does. It doubles, keeps doubling. Half the world is not afraid of chicken heart one day, and the next day, you know, the entire world is consumed. These are both geometric progressions of growth, okay? But it's wishful thinking, okay? And it's mentioned in this article, and it's important to explain it as being the mathematical economic standard that's used to try to create these markets and to try to explain them and try to garner them and give them value. So, and then at the bottom, I've got Google, Microsoft, and Apple comparing their cash on hand with just their capital, what they can invest in, what they control. Google's at about $33 billion, Microsoft at $43 billion, and Apple at $51 billion. And again, these have grown since 2011 when this article was written. But still, they control more capital than the state of California. Right now, we're looking at what was $100 billion roughly in the state budget of California being reduced in this last year to $85 billion, and now they're talking about another $15 billion to be cut from that down to $70 billion. And you can see easily there's $127 billion of value just in those three companies alone. Such concentration of wealth. Wired magazine had an article that talked about the World Wide Web and said that it was in decline and that apps were going to take over the internet. And there was an explanation in this article that gave, and this was not part of this article, but it's something I picked up and tried to help explain what's going on with the internet. And if we look at the last 20 years of the internet, and back in 1990, there was practically no web at all. Okay, in 2000, it peaked, as you can see there. The web is that big portion down in the bottom, that pyramid that kind of comes up and down, and it comes back down again to about 23% on the right side in 2010. This article was written in 2010, and so it reflects numbers from that period. But you look at that center part there, that's 57% on the left side back in 1990, and that grew progressively smaller as the web grew. That FTP, that's File Transfer Protocol. That's when we used to dial things in with our, you know, by printing, or not printing, but it was, everything had to be described with letters and numbers. You had to identify the website that you wanted to go to. GUI, the graphic user interface, took over, and that's why that FTP, the File Transfer Protocol, shrunk. And then there was growth in the web because the web used the graphic user interface. Okay, that's where we're pointing and clicking and doing things like that. That's an important distinction because what's grown is peer-to-peer and video, especially video. You look at video, it's 51% of all the U.S. internet traffic in 2010 was from video. And that's significant because people are using so much video that it's flooding the, the bandwidth, thank you. And what's really important in that blue section, where peer-to-peer didn't even exist in 1990, and then looked like about 1995 or so, peer-to-peer started to pick up. Peer-to-peer is where, my understanding of this is limited, but it's the avoidance of using centralized servers, so that I could have a company and we could use a peer-to-peer system, and it wouldn't even be on the internet. It would be our own peer-to-peer system. And the biggest peer-to-peer system, as you see it grow, just at about 2000 and then beyond, that's when Napster existed. And Napster was a peer-to-peer system that allowed people to essentially trade anything they had. If you have data, you could switch it, pass it along, and it was found to be illegal because it angered a lot of people. Because it supposedly violated so many copyright laws. And so Napster was put out of business. And so we've seen a real change from kind of the geeky side where the file transfer protocol ruled over to this kind of video kind of experience on the internet. And then finally, information as a public good. I just kind of alluded to the copyright law. The temporary rights are usually just 14 years, but they've been extended and lengthened to become essential permanent copyrights. The whole point of a copyright is to give monopoly rights to publishers, especially, and owners of the means of production of media. The people who actually write stuff, journalists, don't have copyrights. It's usually the publishers and the folks who have control the media that have those copyrights. The marginal costs, and that's the cost it takes to produce something. So let's say I have to pay Dan Garrity $100 to write an article for my website. Well, after 100 people have seen my, and I get contributions or hits for each person who sees it, after 100 people see it, then it's paid for. If 1,000 people see it, I just made $900. If 1,000,000 people see it, that marginal cost of media production is practically non-existent. And in fact, that's what happened in the 1930s with radio. Because radio allowed a place like KDKA in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, to put up this really expensive radio station. But as soon as they started selling advertising and realized, and the advertisers realized that there were millions of people listening to this stuff, they were able to cut their marginal costs of production, and so they were making money hand over fist. And they could actually do it for virtually nothing. The $100 that I paid you to write that article, or $100 I paid you to do a radio production, a voiceover, that's nothing compared to the millions I can make, right? Because there's millions of people listening to it. Cable and satellite create, those systems create scarcity that can be converted into corporate wealth because there it could be ding. Digital rights management also looked into that or invaded and created scarcity because it imposed artificial limitations upon the functionalities of digital devices. So when I buy a CD or a DVD, a CD for music and a DVD for a movie, I can't copy it. I try to copy it, and there's a program on there that keeps me from doing that. That's what digital rights management does. And iTunes has the world's largest owned system, proprietary system. So music, access to data, telecommunications, all of this has been essentially, and copyright law has impinged upon information as a public good. Now, as far as journalism is concerned, one of the matter of journalism is brought up by these authors, and they indicate that under civil rights, journalism is a required element to support free press in a democratic society. But the revenue base is insufficient to support journalism because the content is meant for immediate consumption, unlike entertainment, news, movie, books, movies, and so on. And the federal government no longer subsidizes public media the way it used to. Back in the 1840s, the authors indicate that the equivalent of $30 to $35 billion in government subsidies were paid to newspapers to be able to publish public media. But in 2011, it was the equivalent of about $400 million. So nearly a tenfold difference in the government subsidies occurred just in the last, since the mid-19th century. In 1960, and this was something of interest to you, Dan Bacher, and maybe you can talk about this later, the ratio of public relations people to journalists in 1960 was 1-to-1, which I think is rather high, really, when you think about it. I've got a beat reporter out there, but then I've got also somebody advertising copy to be able to keep the beat reporter out there and have me make a profit. That was back in 1960. So 1-to-1. So if I had 100 reporters, I also had 100 people selling advertising. Now, or at least in 2011, it was 4-to-1. So we've really gone from the purpose of I won't say purpose. The relationship between sales and journalism has really flip-flopped to the point where journalists are now actually doing some sales as a result. I think that's something I'd like to have you talk about too, Dan Verity. I just got an email from a friend back east who said that who used to. It just retired, but he sold a lot of copy, advertising copy, to be able to write stories. And it was astonishing at how much of his time was spent selling, as an editor, selling advertising to be able to write that one story. Phenomenal. There's also huge advertising revenue losses due to Craigslist alone takes $20 billion annually. That's how much has been cited in this article in revenue losses to newspapers. And there's been a degradation of journalism. We talked about first quality and then now in quantity. And we can see that because if we're spending more time and money on advertising, then obviously we don't have that much of an effort in writing. So the authors ask, will the internet provide the market basis for resources sufficient to spawn a viable independent mass journalism? Will it be that friction-free capitalism that allows us to, you know, hey, the leisure of capital of journalism will be, you know, fully funded? I don't think that's been the case, and I think the answer is definitely no. Matthew Hindman is a political communications professor at George Washington University. He said, we should not confuse the right to speak with the ability to be heard. And that's really an interesting twist on the First Amendment. You know, the fact that I can say something, you know, in the middle of a room with nobody listening isn't the same as being able to go down to the radio station that's run by our university over here, or our television station that's owned by the public media, that gets money from the federal government. Why can't we put shows on those radio shows at that and TV shows at those venues? So that's an important consideration that was brought up in the article. And it also mentions in the article that the Google search mechanism encourages implicit censorship. We've talked about those three areas, the corporate control, the concentration of power, and the public good. Now, to kind of get an understanding of why that's the case, and what I introduced here at the beginning of this presentation was this Lauderdale paradox that talked about the inverse correlation between public wealth, or use value, and private riches, the exchange value. James Maitland was the 8th Earl of Lauderdale, in, as you can see, in the late 18th and early 19th century. And he said, public wealth consists of all that man desires as useful or delightful to him. So in other words, the utility of a thing is very important. That's public wealth, use value. Private riches are, he wrote, all that man desires as useful or delightful to him, which exists in a degree of scarcity, so that there is an exchange or a market out there that creates that scarcity. And finally, the common sense of mankind would revolt at any proposal to augment private riches by creating a scarcity of any commodity generally useful and necessary to man. I sometimes find it hard to believe that in the United States there is much revolt against any creation of scarcity. You have to almost go out of this country to other countries to see revolts against scarcity creation, such as, you know, in some of the African, or the efforts by Thames Water or other water purveyors that have been through the International Monetary Fund, World Bank. They build dams and then restrict people's access to water and build them for water, and then there are revolts against that. I mean, but that's what Lauderdale brings up as this. There is a revolt against creating scarcity, something that is generally needed and useful to man. One of the concerns that I think Seth, you had at the dinner, was that that the Lauderdale paradox is just from the classical economics period. It's not even Marx at this point. Marx goes further, but I'll explain Ricardo and Jean-Baptiste Say. Ricardo built on the Lauderdale paradox to say that the use and exchange values are very different. Jean-Baptiste Say indicated that they were inherently the same and blurred the distinction between the two. And did so for good reason, because there was a need to create this delusion that everything is an exchange value, that everything is a commodity or can be a commodity, and that everything can therefore come under the tyranny of exchange value. John Stuart Mill, as opposed to Ricardo, instead of talking about water, talked about air and said that though the most absolute of necessities bears no price in the market because it can be obtained gratuitously for free. And if from any revolution in nature the atmosphere became too scanty for the consumption, or it could be monopolized, meaning that, let's say you were going underwater and you needed, you know, air down there underwater, or for some reason it became so polluted, and we're familiar with that, that you would have to actually have clean air and have systems to clean air. Air might acquire a very high marketable value. However rich the possessor of air might become at the expense of the rest of the community. In other words, that exchange value would rise, but the use value would essentially be still there, but there wouldn't be enough for everyone to have. So the public wealth is decreased and private riches are increased. All persons else would be poorer by all that they were compelled to pay for what they had before obtained without payment. And Marx went still beyond that and said that he saw that there was a contradiction between use and exchange value, and that the system of capitalism is predicated upon the accumulation of exchange value at the expense of use values. So, in conclusion, the internet is being transformed into a few dominant spaces. We talked about corporate control and corporate concentration and the denigration of the public good in terms of information. Human communication is not a market. If it is a market, then it has to be a commodity. And when one tries to commodify it, it has to become scarce in order to attain value on the exchange, in its exchange. And finally, the authors suggest that a global network of resistance is both necessary and feasible, which to me gives some hope that what we've been doing and some of the struggle that we encounter is part of a global network, and so we're all kind of together. So I'd like to share with you Wiley's non sequitur cartoon from last Sunday. Did anybody see this at all? Or you saw it Sunday? Yeah. So it says this way to access the power of knowledge, and you know, he's climbing a mountain and skipping over barriers and going through a cave, and then he's walking a tight wire. He's almost there. He made it. The power of knowledge is at hand. He looks down, and it's the public library. So that's kind of where we've come in terms of the internet. As they were introduced earlier, Dan Bacher is a writer for Alternet, an internet publishing site where he documents the power of politics of water and natural resources in California. By the way, Dan, I made this up, so if any of it's wrong, just let me know. Because you didn't give me a bio.
No, you're perfect.
Oh, okay. You write for and work for the Fish Network magazine, which follows sport fishing trends in California and is a frequent guest early Saturday mornings on KFBK's Outdoor Adventure Show with Bob Sims. He's a longtime activist with deep ties to the environmental and Native American communities. And then Dan Garrity, a blogger since 2002. He's operated ElkRoadNews.net and co-hosted a weekly radio program, Left Turn on Bird Street. I've never heard any of those, so if you have any archives, you're going to have to share them with me. He wrote a blog for that program. He has 20 years of editorial and advertising experience in print media. He served with me on the Elk Grove Community Planning Advisory Council, County of Sacramento, until Elk Grove Incorporated in 2000. So that's my presentation, and I want to thank you for your attention.
That was really illuminating.
That took a half an hour, so I apologize for how long that took.
That was really illuminating.
Do we want to break, or do you want to sit down and talk for a few minutes, and then we'll break again? Or I have a couple chairs over here. We could just get into a circle. Did it not shut off? Or?
How are you down?
What's that? Sure. Yeah.
I don't know how to turn this off.
Oh, and there's a power button.
No. Oh. Now, yes, this is the power button. Mm-hmm. Right. So I press it, and I'm supposed to. No.
Well, I went on and broke the machine, so. Oh, is that it?
All right, yeah. Okay. Now, when it stops blinking, then it's okay to unplug it.
Oh, okay. No, I was just going to unplug this part here.
You can unplug your computer.
There's no
unplug. Don't
okay.
Turn off the juice to the thing until it stops blinking.
All right.
Hot water over there.
Do you want me to start or do you want me to start?
Yeah, why don't we, I'll tell you what, let's just pull a couple chairs out here. Just, you know, you want to do that?
Yeah.
Have a seat.
Yeah,
that's right, yeah.
So you want me to start or? Okay. His biography was right. Just a few things wanted to add. That I've been writing online for the internet about water, fish, environmental justice, also some on peace and social justice issues since 1997. So I've been on the internet for 15 years writing and seeing a lot of the changes, what it was, you know, a lot earlier, when there would seem to be a lot less concentration and more freedom on the internet, at least in my opinion. I publish several blogs at Alternet, Indie Bay, Daily Cause, Sacramento for Democracy, and then Caltechs. And I also write for Counterpunch, Red, Green, and Blue, Yuga.net, Noyo News, and Sacramento California Progress Report.
They pick up some of my articles. And then I've written a lot of articles in the past for Sacramento News Review and Native California News, which is a Native American news magazine. I'm going to talk about my experience and some things that stuck out in the article. The first thing is that the analysis of the outcome of the internet and what's happened through media concentration is dead on in this article. The quote that I'm going to read is, to put it another way, if the internet actually improved the world over the past 20 years as much as the champions once predicted, we dread to think where the world would be if it had never existed. And we joke at the office in my full-time job, how our incomes have gone down because of the internet, about how it's tougher for us because we make most of our money off print journalism, but we don't have a website, how things have gotten worse, and how we spend more time to make less money. And that's the way it is with everybody, Sacramento Bee, whatever. And that's because the print journal, in the last 20 years, print journalism and internet journalism has become merged. In other words, it's really hard to separate corporate media print journalism from corporate media internet journalism. And then also with the alternative media, you know, the alternative press generally will have a news site on the internet. And because of this whole trend, you know, which I've seen personally, it's led to the decline of working journalists and the emergence of internet corporate propagandists. That's really increased in the last 5 years that I've seen. And the quote I got out of here, I just love this quote. The number of working journalists per capita began to decline by the late 1980s, though corporate news media profits were booming. In the first decade of the new century, the number of journalists fell off a cliff. Wow, I can sure relate to that. In 1960, the ratio of public relations people attempting surreptitiously to doctor the news to working journalists was around 1-to-1. In 2011, and Mike pointed this out in his presentation, the ratio approaches 4-to-1. Large sections of public life are barely covered anymore, and those that are rely to a much larger extent on the unfiltered missives of PR firms. And I think that when he meant PR professionals, he meant not just advertising people, but he meant the plethora of lobbyists and people that have PR websites. To spin stuff. And at work, me and my partner, Cal Kellogg, we call it verbal blowjobs. That's our name for it. And whenever
is that part of the marriage?
Yeah. And and I thought it was funny because of that whole marriage thing, but we call it, and the ad salesmen are always trying to get us to do a verbal blowjob, and we say that, you want another verbal blowjob? Didn't they just get one? You know? But, and it's really, I mean, it's just increased dramatically, and this statistic right there documents it. And it's, and you know, the final thing that I want to talk about is my somewhat unnerving experience today when I got a press release from Governor Jerry Brown that he appointed a man named Mike Tower of Benicia to the position of Assistant Deputy Director of Communications, Education, and Outreach at the California Department of Fish and Game. Okay, has anybody ever read this guy's journalism? Anybody ever familiar with Mike Tower? Okay, I'll just explain. He's a excellent journalist. He's been a reporter for the Bay Area News Group and Contra Costa Times since 2000, and he's really known for his extensive coverage of the Sacramento San Joaquin Delta vet issues. He covered the when the whistleblowers from state and federal governments basically had a conference and decided to go public with a dramatic decline of 4 species of fish and also plankton that was occurring on the Delta. I mean, precipitous decline. And they pinned it on Delta water exports, in other words, taking water from the Delta, Southern California corporate agribusiness, to toxic chemicals and to increases in invasive species. Well, he covered that. He broke that story, and then I broke it at the simultaneously with him. So, you know, I know the guy pretty well. He also covered a wonderful news story on the exposing a corporate agribusinessman who completely controls politics in California named Stuart Resnick, who's the owner of Paramount Farms. He has, depending on what statistics you look at and data, he has anywhere from 120,000
to 200,000 acres. Kern County is the largest fruit grower in the world. He's also the largest contributor to Jerry Brown campaign, Daryl Steinberg's campaign, Barbara Boxer's campaign, Dianne Feinstein's campaign, and donated money to both Barack Obama and Bush. He also to, you know, besides Brown's campaign, he donated, I guess, just under a million to Schwarzenegger. So this guy exposes. And one reason why I'm saying this, he did some really good journalism, traditional journalism, not breaking journalism. And I
not Resnick, but Tower.
Yeah, right? Tower of this guy Resnick, who's a, and he exposed this, and I found it good because he'd already done the research, and I could use his data and quote in articles. Okay, today I found out that he's been hired, but basically co-opted by the Brown administration that wants to build a peripheral canal, and they hired him because he was the only mainstream reporter, media reporter on the internet and print reporting on these issues in a fair balance, and covering the issues, trying to dig at the truth. Now I'm alone. There's nobody else.
So that voice resigned.
That voice, and he's been, and I don't know his reasons. I don't know if he got fired from the other place or they were going to put, you know, or is, I have no idea, or he asked them for the job or whatever, but it's really alarming because he's being hired as the PR guy, going back to this, the 4-to-1 ratio of PR people to news people. Now you have these people that are constantly migrating from the corporate media and alternative media to either government posts or private corporate posts. And then they go back between all three of them. It's like a revolving door, government, media, and corporations. And what's disturbing is that there's been a lot of it that's happened in the water field. For instance, Tom Filth, who was a former Sacramento editor, now works as an executive strategist of Metropolitan Water District. And guess what he covered with the bee? Their water and fish issues. Oh, yeah. And now he's the guy that's lobbying for the peripheral canal and the destruction of the Delta. And Mike Tower's voice has been silenced. You know, we're talking, he's working for a fishing game for the Brown administration. In one sense, there'd be one positive thing, that there'll be a guy there that wouldn't want to get a quotes on a story that will sympathizes with me as a journalist and will try to do the best to get the information, you know, for me to do a story, to quote somebody, to interview somebody. But the fact that he's been taken out of the journalism field is really damaging. Another classic example of this, just like Mike Tower, is that Tupper Hull, who was a San Francisco Examiner reporter and then he became a spokesman for the Westlands Water District, which is the Darth Vader of California water politics. I mean, they are a true evil in California water politics.
Everyone, and water, Westlands is the west side of the San Joaquin Valley,
and it's,
which has so much toxic...
selenium
was one of the big things that came out 20 years ago.
But the big key thing here is that it's not really about farming. What it is about is that these people are getting water, subsidized water, that they want, them, both Westlands and Stuart Resnick, that they either are now selling it back to the public, to different water agencies in Southern California, other people that want water, or they want to, in the future, expand through water transfer. So it's a whole corporate water gambling scheme.
That's entrepreneurialism.
Yeah.
Let's create another middleman.
Yeah, right.
Let's let Stu Resnick sell the water.
So this is cave again. So this you know, and I think the internet is really okay. It's had its good things, okay, and from the positive side, at least particularly in the beginning, is that alternative media could really prosper. But then that's been increasingly corporatized. A lot of alternative media websites have been bought off by corporations, or they've now got, yes?
Well, the classic example of that is Arianna Huffington is selling her Huffington Post to AOL, America Online, for $300 million. And she had, Huffington had something on the order of about 1,000 people who wrote, who blogged for no pay.
Yeah.
Just because they wanted to share organized labor campaign to basically Huffington, Arianna Huffington, to change, which, you know, garnered of riches, and that's sort of the Huffington Post, the corporatization.
And here's an even bigger tie back to water. Okay, it just happens to be that her best friend is, guess who? Stuart Resnick. Okay. The guy that Mike Tower exposed or helped to expose, and it was her website would not print any environmental articles other than complete and total corporate greenwashing by NRDC Environmental Defense. So that was a alternative, but more like alternative corporate greenwashing site. I mean, they wouldn't publish anything by me. They wouldn't publish anything by anybody that was involved in environmental justice. It was all greenwashing, cap and trade, building the peripheral canal, and serving corporate agribusiness. Yes.
Yeah, I was wondering. There's a lot of not real small, pretty small farmers, family farms throughout the valley. I wonder what a good water policy would be, especially down in the San Joaquin water for their farms and so forth.
Right.
Cherries and grapes or whatever.
Well, San Joaquin County is thought of now as this national or a state sacrifice zone for the Westlands Water District and Stuart Resnick. There's very clear, okay. And Sacramento Valley to a certain extent. In other words, these are all primary, they have primary water rights, but the Westlands Water District is now working with Dianne Feinstein to essentially give Westlands water rights, which, and from the very beginning, these corporate farmers did this as part, as a scam. You know, they did it as a, you know, knowing that they would be getting water, and then they could sell that water, they could get subsidized for not growing crops, and growing crops. Now there's actual farmers, particularly in the Delta, that have farmed there for years, that have farms in the family. Jerry Brown wants to take vast tracts of their land out of production, productive, good, river bottom, alluvial soil, so that water can be sent to Stuart Resnick, who owns half of the Kern Water Bank. And he, in turn, will sell that to Southern California water districts so that they can develop into the Southern San Joaquin Valley. And so that Westlands can continue and increase its production. Although it doesn't make any sense because a lot of it land has already been taken out of agricultural production because it's too salty, too toxic, the farm.
Well, that's a good reason to.
Yes. So it's really it's real interesting in the water battle. It's an interesting mix of people. You know, we got conservative family farmers and grassroots environmentalists, grouchy old fishermen, American Indian tribal leaders. Local counties and some water districts that will, you know, against the big corporate guys down in the San Joaquin. So it's a real motley crew, a coalition, and somewhat uneasy coalition at times because we have real differences, although we have a common goal of fighting the bad guys like Westlands and Stuart Resnick.
How does the internet hurt you and help you in terms of this battle? And just as an example, okay. Water battles.
Give an example. It really helps us in that on these blogs, I can put the conflicts of interest and get it up there. And you see, for instance, Yuba.net picks my stuff up. So that means Sacramento Bee picks my stuff up. because they're a sister site to the Sacramento Bee. So it's interesting. I'll go up to the editorial where they got all this information on the Sacramento Bee page and how great the Peripheral Canal is, and then right next to it will be my article on that. So you see, there is a positive benefit that you can use. And a lot, you know, they're not looking at what particular articles are going up there. Of course, they might after a while. But, you know, the whole thing is that they do it by websites. They want to get more people looking at the Bee website so they have links to other websites.
They want free copy.
Yeah, they want a free copy.
What you're referring to is something that Sacramento Bee has called
Sacramento
Connect, of which I'm part of. So, yeah, you're right. They'll have a story about one thing, and that's one of the, I guess, other things about the Internet. It's kind of a dichotomy, I guess, is that they need copy. They're giving, you know, some of the sites like the Bee are, you know, they're cutting their, the number of reporters they have out on the street. So they're looking to people like me, basically, to give them copy about news that's going on in Elk Grove. So it's
without paying for it.
Without paying for it. And this is maybe where, like, the business side of the Internet comes in. So I agree to be part of that because that brings traffic to my site from people that I might not, like yourself, might not otherwise get.
Right.
And the more traffic I get to my site ultimately equates into more earnings that I can generate for myself. So it's
theoretically.
Well, it is. In actuality, it has helped me in terms of the amount of revenue I can generate.
But that's good.
Sorry to cut you off.
Yeah, and so that's the good thing. The bad thing is exactly what he pointed out. So there's a benefit, like you get exposed more, that can generate traffic to your website, and you can possibly make more money. But not everybody does, okay? On the other hand, what they're doing is they're getting free labor.
Right.
Okay. And I'm looking at the overall picture. My income 10 years ago, my income now, it's actually lower. And it is with most reporters. They're getting part-time, like with the Bee, they had a big purge there. I mean, it wasn't really political or anything, but they lost all their best reporters, like Edgar Sanchez, Dorothy Corber, really good reporters, and they agreed to take a buyout, you know, and get just a lump sum where they left the paper. And this increasing, the Internet, like I said, it's the worst thing that ever happened to journalism, and it's the best thing, and it's a real contradiction there. And the resistance has to be built on that. On one hand, we have alternative journalists have access to the world that they never had before. On the other hand, that access is controlled and concentrated by ISPs like Google and other corporations. And at any time, somebody wants to, they can really, really shut down freedom of speech on the Internet. And that's what's really scary.
Is WikiLeaks a good example?
Yeah.
Dan Garrity, I'd like to have you kind of talk about it.
And that's pretty much,
I didn't want to cut you off, but I didn't want to get to.
That's the final thing is, you know, it's like, it's, yeah, my thing is, I guess my summary is that the Internet is the best thing, the worst thing that's ever happened to journalism. And the classic example I'll give is Sacramento Bee grabbed three of my stories a few years ago. They didn't tell me. Didn't edit them, and they grabbed them from a blog. Didn't even know. Somebody told me, somebody else told me about all three of them, and that was good. I got exposure. But then again, they reprinted and made money off my labor, and I didn't get compensated. And that's really bad.
Yeah, I think the labor is one of the bigger, the how you get paid, really. And let me just tell you a little bit about my site. My site, I've been blogging since about 2002. As Mike has said in the introduction, I had a radio program, and we had an accompanying blog to it, and ran that for about 4 years. And then about 2005, I could see it down in Elk Grove, where Mike and I both live. that the local newspaper, the Elk Grove Citizen, was, in my opinion, just full of fluff. It's kind of a,
that's being nice.
Yeah, well, it was a kind of a Chamber of Commerce type publication. The Bee, actually, in fairness, they used to have a pretty good bureau down in Elk Grove.
They did.
And then that was one of the first things they cut earlier in the decade. So I could see there was a need, and I can be a loudmouth. So I started my own blog, and I started writing about local politics primarily, and that's still the primary focus. You know, as we related to advertising, I did it initially as, lack of better description, a hobby. I've done some writing in the past. I worked for primarily legal publications. And I started writing in the mid-90s. And then earlier part of the 2000s, I guess, I wrote for one of the Citizens newspapers. I was I freelanced for them for about 5 years.
Elk Grove Citizen?
Yeah, for the River Valley Times. Anyhow, I can see in Elk Grove there, a lot of the things that were happening just were not being reported, in my view. So I started it, and I started it kind of as a hobby, lack of better description. And it's evolved since that point. And when you talk, there are some interesting things, I'm basically Elk Grove News. I have contributors like Mike, and I have a few other contributors, but it's, mostly produced by myself. I have sold some advertising, and the advertising that I sold directly by myself, I didn't solicit, it kind of came to me. So I've never had that, I've never, in my experience, never had to, I never sought advertising. So, and the reason I did that, because I didn't need the money at that particular time, and it gave me the freedom not to have to have that kind of inherent conflict that you have between advertising and editorial. It's an inherent conflict. As my site has evolved over time, I've become part of a advertising network, and like yourself, my income is down over the last several years in the recession. So I very pragmatic view, I'd say, well, how can I generate some money from this? I tried the Google AdSense, which, I generated $100 in about 6 months. And I'm thinking to myself, these guys are making money off of me. I finally became part of what's called the Sacramento Local Online Advertising Network, which is part of sacramentopress.com. It's a group called Mercer Media. And it works out real well for me because they go out and solicit the ads. They do all the artwork. They collect the money. I just put the code on my site and the ads appear. So I still, it works well for me because I have a little bit of a model now where I'm actually beginning to generate some revenue. But the advertisers don't know me. I don't know the advertisers. So if I offend them in my ad copy, I'm not. It's not one of my considerations. So that's kind of how I've tackled that particular challenge, because there is there's a certain pragmatism you have to have. I don't spend a lot of money on my site. I do everything I can on the cheap. From my business cards to the hosting, I pay for my domain, and obviously I have some. I've bought some camera and a new computer and this sort of thing over the years, but. I do expend a fair amount of time on it, and my time is worth something to me. I could be doing something else, like watching TV all night, like I did last night. But my time is worth something. So this model has actually worked fairly well for me. So I can get some revenue, and I do have freedom because it's kind of like, there's a wall there. And, to their credit, Sacramento Press, they have 50 different local blogs in their site, and like some of the blogs and websites that they have in their network will have different ads than mine. They're looking at the demographics, what goes on in Elk Grove. So it works works well for me in terms of generating it. But I think the bigger challenge that I read from the story, and that was really a very thought-provoking story, couple of things jumped out at me. For one, the public relations ratio. You're right. You know,
unbelievable.
There's this all sorts of garbage that you'll see in I see in emails, and the next day you'll see in Sacramento Bee or whatnot.
Yeah, right.
They'll do a little bit of a rewrite, you know, because it's free
right.
copy for them. Just as a side note, have you ever heard of a group out of, I think they're out of Madison, Wisconsin, called the Center for Media and Democracy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm on there. They have a part of their service or mission is they have a thing called PR Watch. And they do a pretty good job of, you know, watching the spin that goes out into the mainstream media. But beyond that, the bigger points in the story that I thought were really interesting was one, and this is, I think, the biggest challenge to the internet, is that, and Mike touched upon it, and I certainly experienced this in my life, is that in Elk Grove, where I live, there's only one provider, I think. I think where I live in Elk Grove, I can only go to two. I can get either Comcast or Frontier as my internet service provider. I think you have Sure West over in your neighborhood, so you have three choices.
Sure West is the one we have.
Right, but
it's restricted because it's a fiber optic line.
Right.
Only certain neighborhoods.
Yeah, they didn't lay them down in my neighborhood or whatever reason. You know, I don't have access to it. But I think in the story, one point, and I think it's kind of lost in all of this, is, and I think it was referenced that Senator Al Gore, when he was talking about the information superhighway, as the internet was kind of first called, was that it should be run something like the interstate highway. And, you know, it should be something that's run as a public utility by the government versus private access. And the issue of censorship and control to the access, I think that's a big concern that I have. And I think that, you know, it's like trying to put toothpaste back into the tube. It's already out, and I don't think the, you know, the private internet service providers are going to be willing to give that up. And I think that's one of the big mistakes that was made early on, was that instead of running it like the interstate highway system, which now, interestingly, they're starting to privatize in certain sections around the country with toll roads, you know, we've let that out. And I think the other thing that Mike pointed out, and they pointed out in that story, and this is the bigger concern, or as big a concern from my perspective, is the Telecommunications Act of 1996. You know, that changed the whole landscape. All of a sudden, you know, here in Sacramento, we had, I don't know, how many, we still have the same number of AMs and FM stations, but before, where we might have had 18 owners, we now have two or three companies that basically control all the commercial radio stations. And furthermore, you can have own newspapers, radio stations, television stations, all the media in the same outlet, where prior to that, and particularly, I think some of these rules were loosened in the 80s, but the Telecommunication Act was the big thing. So basically, as it relates to the internet, it's no coincidence that CNN, you know, Google, you know, all these other big major sites, they're getting all the traffic. And then, like you said, Google is kind of the gatekeeper. You know, I did, you know, just as a side note, I had one little stroke of luck with my news site. Is if you do a search on Google, not a news search, because I can't quite qualify as a news source yet.
Why is that?
Because that's a whole other story. You know, I've been trying to deal with that for the last year and a half. But if you do a web search for Elk Grove News, I come up at the top because it's the most relevant. So there is some luck in, you know, your name. But I can't be qualified as a news source because, ironically, I found out because I use their free hosting service, they don't consider me a news source because I don't pay for my service, even though I use their free service. So I'm kind of trying to do a workaround.
Who's saying?
Google
really?
Is a blogger. Blogger is the company that hosts
that's
the platform.
Bizarre.
But I think, you know, in terms of the whole internet picture, you know, I think it's you know, advertising revenues are going to be important to smaller people like myself, you know, and I think there are some opportunities still, but it has to be really small. I was talking to Seth a little bit earlier before we started, and I'm in, you know, just through kind of osmosis, I'm building a network of writers that we're publishing and cross-publishing each other's work for free. We're non-corporate, you know, we're not necessarily profit-motivated, but there's this kind of natural progression happening where there are networks that are evolving. Whether they go very far or not, it's too early to say, I think. That's one thing that does make me somewhat hopeful. But in terms of competing on a national basis, I think all that hope is gone, really. I mean, it's a few major corporations on the internet that are controlling things. So I guess from my perspective, if you want to look for local news, local news is maybe an opportunity and where you can get maybe the most unvarnished news. As far as the bigger picture on the internet, like you're saying, it's kind of the best of times and it's kind of the worst of times at the same time. There's a lot more information available. You have to find it, but Google is a gatekeeper on it. So,
I'm just interested in terms, what are the hot issues now in Elk Grove? Because I've been out of touch since I've been down.
Well, in Elk Grove, the biggest issue, I guess, overall would be the what they call the sphere of influence is Elk Grove's trying to annex 3,000 more acres for development in primarily in agricultural near the Cosumnes Water.
They already got that,
you know,
big old
Cosumnes River watershed area. That's
a big
issue.
Nowhere.
Yeah, and of course they have this uncompleted mall down there, so I think that's the biggest issue.
Not to mention the connector,
so-called
connector along Cameron Road.
Right.
It's supposed to connect Hood Franklin,
yeah,
which is the middle of nowhere, to El Dorado Hills. It's the freeway.
What?
From El Dorado Hills to
Franklin.
Yeah, to Hood Franklin.
Well, it goes from 5 across the 99 up Grantline and up
to
basically
this
El Dorado.
Would be
Hills.
Like a freeway? It's a bypass.
Yeah,
it's a bypass. And instead of
just
doing a regular bypass, they're doing this kind of rural bypass to enable Elk Grove's development, right, to then center around that. And one of the city councilmen there, Pat Hume, is kind of a slickster real estate guy who essentially his father-in-law, I believe, was the guy who built all the homes there. I live in one of them.
Stepfather.
Or is it stepfather?
No, okay. Well, no, it's his uncle.
Or his uncle? Okay,
yeah, right.
The Guthridge family.
Right.
Anyway, yeah. And so, but this guy is always making these sweetheart deals, and you can catch him sometimes talking about, you can ask questions like, well, what's the relevance? Why are we building this road to nowhere in the middle of nowhere? And he'll admit to owning property or controlling property,
right,
or having dibs on property that's surrounding. Well, there's all this property, and I know about it because I'm, you know, doing business with it. And it's like, well, but isn't that a conflict of interest? You know, and so does that get reported by the citizen?
I'm really the only one who, you know, I'm not trying to sit here bragging about it. And I have limited time and limited resources. But I am the only one who's really kind of out there reporting it. And that's the other, I guess, just in terms of the state of the media itself, is I point to the movie in 1974. I saw it when I was a high school student, and it blew me away. And I watched it a few years ago, and it blew me away again, was the 1974 film Network. And basically everything in that movie Network predicted what has happened in the news media. You know, we've gone from having this hard news reporting investigative journalism to kind of this infotainment, you know, and I think, you know, down in Elk Grove anyhow, you know, and a lot of the other newspapers, they're not willing to, you know, rattle the cages of the public officials. And I see that, you know, in a very long term, I see that as a real problem for our democracy, such as it is. Because if you can't, you know, you have to make a living still. Invariably, you have to feed your family, put a roof over your house. And if you can't do that, you're not going to have time to go out and dig up the dirt on our elected officials. And I don't want to sit up here and talk about like I'm on the Art Bell show or something like that. But it almost fits this like model of corporate, the corporatization of the world, of the United States, and really the world for that matter, where we're kind of fed the information that they want to feed us. And it's I'm veering way off now, but when you have three or four corporations controlling access to the internet, and then you have four or five different corporations controlling information on the internet vis-a-vis videos now too, it's pretty easy to control people. And I see a lot of complacency. I've done a lot of reporting over the last several years, but I see a lot of complacency amongst people in my little world down in Elk Grove. Unless it's something that's smacking them upside the head, they could care less. Yes, sir.
I'm kind of getting a couple of terms straight. Now, blogging, I guess, that's where people go back and forth. Is that what it is?
No, blogging is kind of a loosely defined. It's really an abbreviation for a web log, kind of like a personal journal. And so when you say somebody has a blog, it usually means it's focused on, I prefer to call myself as a news site, because a blog might tend to focus more on one particular thing as it relates to that person. Now, I know, Dan, you have blogs, but your blogs are part of like a maybe of a subset of a particular site.
Yeah. What I do, just so you get the idea, and I didn't understand what a blog was first, but it's like that's a real good description. It's like a page or a diary, and I was given one by Alternate, by Calitex. Alternate asked me to blog, and then somebody else. And that's different from a regular website where I got to submit and then they put it up there. In other words, with the blog, I'm in charge of it. It's great. I think it's great, because what I do is when I write an article, I'll write the article and then I'll go from blog to blog and paste the same article. Okay? And then I'll send it out to my list, and then different websites will pick it up. So Counterpunch will pick it up if it's kind of a national issue. So will Red, Green, and Blue. Yuba.net will pick it up. And those are websites.
You should send it to me, too.
Yeah, I should send it to you.
But
you see, the blog, just the great thing about it is that when I send an article out to a website, a news website, and then I make a mistake, it's really hard to get it changed, because people are so busy. The great thing about blogs is I can go back, all five of them, I can go, if I have somebody points out a big mistake, I can go back through and change it all. Or if I want to rewrite that article, because I've got some updated, like today I got updated, and I completely rewrote the article, and I just put it back in the same spot. So it's really valuable.
Well, I'm confused now. I always thought that website and blog are the same thing. Can you contrast between the two technically? I mean, like what you have to do, say that if you wanted a website.
Okay.
Are you Ellen knows this stuff.
Did you have a better answer, Ellen?
I have an answer. A better answer.
Go ahead.
You haven't tried.
No, go ahead. I'm all ears.
A blog is a type of website.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I would put it.
All right.
A blog is a website that's generally within a framework that makes it easy to update directly onto the website. Most traditional websites, you can't edit them directly on the web server. Websites.
Well, how do you get a blog? Just technically.
Technically, you can go to blogger.com or typepad.com or wordpress.com,
and
you can sign up.
Who are these?
Well, Blogger belongs to Google. And right. TypePad, I don't know who the heck it belongs
to. All right,
to.
So you have to
WordPress,
go.
You go to the site of someone who provides a blogging.
So it's a free to go through a provider.
Yeah.
Right,
it's
you need to go through a provider.
It's generally free. It's a free service, too.
Right, but it's still somebody who owns something on the website.
Yes.
It's all web.
A free service.
Right.
Okay.
Okay. A blog is a subset of a website, or it's a type of website that you can edit easily. It has a standard.
Well, you're talking from the point of view of a writer. I'm just trying to understand.
From the point of view of the user, you type in a web address and you go there. It's a kind of a website.
Right.
The main difference between a blog and a website is from the point of view of the person who creates it, is that it's got a template that you can use. You can update it directly. You can have a place for interactive comments or not interactive.
That's a blog.
Whereas a website, you may or may not have to code it manually.
Right.
You need to use FTP.
Counterpunch then is a website, not a blog.
All blogs are websites.
Yeah, Counterpunch, I can't go up there, like on a blog, that's on a larger website, like Alternet. I can go up there and change stuff. I have access to it. Counterpunch is a website that has a webmaster, a traditional website, and you can't post comments, and there's not individual blogs. And if something is wrong, like for instance, in an article, they post something, there's something in there that's a typo, I have to contact the webmaster to change that. So that's essentially...
Well, how do you get a website?
Oh, Murray, would you please just talk to me later about it?
Yeah, you create them. Yeah, there's people that create them and they build them.
I'm interested in the democracy issue here.
You are?
Yeah.
Okay, how do you get a website?
Yeah.
Any website needs a server. It needs a computer somewhere that will
host
your website, be it a blog or a static website or an interactive website or whatever it is. Netflix, anything from Blogger to Netflix to Amazon is a website, and somebody hosts it. And there are a gazillion companies that provide web hosting. Seriously, a gazillion. There's not that many internet service providers that provide you on your computer the ability to access the internet, but the ability to create a website is available from a number of sources. You go and you sign up, you get an account, and they provide you with either a blog or a template.
I'm just trying to get the organization on. This is the last question. So what you're saying is that if you want to go to open your own website like Counterpunch, you have to apply to one of these gazillion companies that are in the business of providing websites.
Yeah, so that's exactly what the Barnes School
did. Then there's one step beyond that, that company in turn pays probably one of the major providers who gives it a chance. Well, where does he get?
You pay them to host your website. They've got a bunch of computers, and they hook their computers into the internet.
How do they get on the internet?
Well,
don't they have to buy space on the
let me just interject something here, because Murray, I think you're getting kind of caught in the details. Remember that chart that I had up there that had the table? It wasn't a table, it was an actual graph. And the graphs showed the rise and fall of the web. Right? Remember how the web started out next to nothing in 1990?
Michael, I think the answer to Murray's question is yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes, they have to pay for an internet connection, but what they pay is for a connection that allows them to send huge amounts of data, but it is not...
I want to just see the organizational ownership... what's that called?
Incrementally, though, they're making more money off of the hosting than Google it.
Right, and the hosting...
Comcast is making off of their T1 line or whatever.
Right, but the hosting that you're describing with the web is different than hosting through a peer-to-peer site, for instance.
Yeah.
Peer-to-peer doesn't use... They use each other's computers as the server, which is kind of a weird thing. It's kind of like, you know, you're driving down the road and your car is now the road.
I mean, it's weird, but that's...
You can. Grandmothers for Peace was hosted off of a computer in Lorraine Crofchot's living room.
Okay. And so, and I'm not sure exactly how that works, but I think instead of getting lost in the details on how some of this works, what we're trying to do is try to understand the fundamental foundation of the setup for these things in economic terms, in terms of the way in which this becomes a market, that essentially they become exchanged commodities. That when you guys write it, or any of us write a story and then submit it, or put it on the blog, or pay a fee, that we're all part of this kind of market for exchange. And I think one of the questions that I have for you guys, especially, I think I wanted to go to Dan Garrity with this, was a lot of your work as a print journalist has been with legal postings and so on.
Right.
And there's a huge amount, I mean, one of the criticisms that you had, and that I didn't even recognize until I picked up a copy recently, of the Elk Grove Citizen as an example, was that virtually all of their advertising was legal postings,
right,
for repossessions of homes.
Right.
I mean, could you kind of spin on that a little bit?
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's an interesting point. I really hadn't thought about it in terms of the contents of the story. But basically, that is a government subsidy that goes to print newspapers. Whenever you pick up your local newspaper, like in Elk Grove, for instance, we still have an ongoing foreclosure problem down there. The government code requires that when a house is foreclosed on, we're a non-judicial foreclosure state. So they have to go down and file a default notice at the court, and then after that, they have to physically go out and post a notice on the house, and then they have to publish this foreclosure notice that has a legal description of the land, how much money is owned, who owes the money, who's supposed to get the money, all the legal details, in a newspaper that is within the judicial district within that county. So if your house is in Folsom and it's being foreclosed, that notice has to go in the Folsom Telegraph. If it's in Elk Grove, it has to go in the Elk Grove Citizen, and so forth. So that, in a sense, those are government subsidies. If you have a probate notice that you're going to probate an estate, that notice has to be published in the newspaper of general circulation. You file a fictitious business name, a civil summons, an adoption citation. There's a whole laundry list and public hearings on certain things. So the government still, you know, I wouldn't say it's a direct, but they mandate subsidies of sorts. Personally, please don't repeat this out in this room, because that's been a part of my living. No, that's okay.
We're recording, but
no, that's okay. It's one of these type of subsidies that I think, if it wasn't for these subsidies, probably half of the newspapers in California would have been out of business 5 or 6 years ago. You look in the Citizen, they have anywhere from 7 to 11 full broadsheet pages of foreclosure ads. And I know just from the revenue on that, it was probably about $1,100 to $1,200 per page. You do the math twice a week, 104 editions a year. And you look in their newspaper, and there's not that much display advertising. There's hardly classified advertising, non-existent. So I'm not going to say if it's good or bad, but the fact is, if it wasn't for the fact that, ironically, the thing that's kept a lot of newspapers in business over the last 5 or 6 years has been the recession.
Well, are these a public good? I mean, do we need that information?
Well, I think there's other, on one hand, the newspaper publishers are going to argue that it's the public's right to know this information of what's going on. It's a way of notifying people that might not otherwise know that their house is being foreclosed on, or their grandmother's probate, their estate's being probated. So newspaper publishers are going to constantly argue that it's the public's right to know, which it is. You know, it's public information. Other people are going to argue, I think, very effectively, and quite frankly, I'm surprised the government hasn't seized on this yet as a source of revenue for themselves. government. You can, I can go. I regularly go to the Sacramento court page, and I can see every civil filing, every criminal case. You know, the documents, particularly for the civil cases, all online. The mechanism is already there. A lot of people don't generally look at that. I'm frankly surprised the government haven't seized on taking those fees away from newspapers, putting them in their own pockets. Of course, it goes back to PR and lobbyists. The California Newspapers, the Newspaper Publishers Association, is a very they still have a very powerful lobby in Sacramento here. So they've been able to keep that off bay. But I think that's one of the things, it's not going to be the internet that kills it. Two things that will kill it, the things that are killing newspapers are Craigslist, first and foremost. Craigslist, whether you like it, loathe it, the reality is when you can put your car for sale on Craigslist for free and sell it that same day versus putting a line ad in the Sacramento Bee and paying $35, the choice is pretty obvious. And the Craigslist really is the thing that's, you know, and not even eBay, but Craigslist in particular has really been...
I hate it.
It's been the dearth of newspapers. It's, you know...
If it's free, how do they make their money?
Well, they do charge for certain ads in certain markets. In Sacramento, they charge for help wanted ads, for employment ads, as they do in San Francisco, you know, the Bay Area, Los Angeles, I think New York, Chicago, the major markets. But all the other ads are for free. So.
Well, maybe not, because when you go to Craigslist, mm-hmm. say, to look for bicycles or something mm-hmm. like that, like I do, sometimes you come across a listing by a commercial outfit.
Mm-hmm.
And there are plenty of them.
Right.
One wonders whether they get the service free.
Yes, they do.
They don't have to pay.
Wow, they don't have to pay.
But they can also be marked as commercial.
Yes, they have to be marked as commercial.
Well, no. I mean, you can say that this is an improperly marked
thing, right.
And then a webmaster will
take it down. Right.
Will take it down. Mm-hmm. Now, is Craigslist technically? It's not a. It wouldn't be a blog per se.
No,
but it's a website.
Like a bulletin board. It's a website, or what we used to call bulletin boards in a sense.
Yeah.
I mean, you go to the site. It's just plain graphics. It's very simple. It's very basic.
And it uses keywords.
You can enter keywords. That's really the thing that it, you know. That's really the I mean, people talk. You know, and now I'm talking from the advertising side of newspapers. You know, people think about, you know, the Sacramento Bee, the inserts and the display ads and you know, all that. Newspapers have traditionally made their cash cow has been classified ads. Because if you start thinking about when they used to have these, you know, all the help wanted ads in the Sunday paper, you have a line ad like that, you know, that was running $250. I mean, you have a whole sheet of those. I mean, you just do the math and that's just... easy money. There's no artwork involved in it. You have a person typesetting it. It gets paginated, and boom, you're done with it. You know, so.
I guess Craigslist is all over the country, right?
It's all over the world.
All over the world. So it's a way again of consolidating the market under a kind of monopoly. Whereas, even though the newspapers were kind of became more and more monopolized. There would be many, many more individually owned newspapers than for advertising mm-hmm. you know, bicycles. Than now it's just Craigslist.
Right. You're right.
There's, go ahead.
I'm just trying to get back. I guess you said you make your money off of your readership. You know, like mm-hmm. I don't know what kind of advertising, the amount you get from the advertising is based on the number of people that are.
Yes.
And are those hits or those subscribers or are they?
No, they're based on page views. I get roughly about 32, 33, the last few months, happily it's been growing, but I've been getting about 31, 32,000 page views a month, which means you could go there and you look at one page and you click on another page, even though you're the same visitor. Each time you go to a different page, that's counted as a page view. My unique visitors are somewhere around 12,000-13,000. So that means every visitor on the average goes to about 2.25 pages. So, yeah, in the internet world, you're paid on basically what they call clicks per thousand, and then there's a rate that's established, and it's not unlike a newspaper rate sheet that you'd get for advertising in the past. And from my perspective, the company that I affiliate with, and I'm speaking on a very personal level now, it's very good for me because I don't have to go out and chase down advertisers, chase down money, chase down artwork, anything like that. So it gives, I will say I'm very happy with it because it helps me generate some earnings for my labor, but I still have that invisible wall that I don't really have to worry about the advertisers because they don't know me, I don't know them. And, you know, if I say anything that offends them, well, tough luck. Maybe, you know, they'll pull my ads or something like that, but I don't think they will. So there's a certain degree of anonymity on it because all these advertisers are looking for are eyeballs, you know, in my little world anyhow. You know, I don't know if this explains, you know, if I'm explaining it.
Yeah, we've got a website. I'm a piece of freedom party. Mm-hmm. I know we don't get any money for anybody looking at it and giving like thousands of, you know, hits.
Right.
We don't get any money for any of that.
Right.
That's why I was kind of curious, you know.
What you could do on yours just as a practical matter, you could go to Google and you could put Google AdSense on AdSense, S-E-N, you know, not C-E-N. But what they'll do on that. I mean, there's good things about Google and bad things about Google. If you had space on there, you could put the HTML code on there, and it's their servers. They have the Google bots are going to go look for all the keywords. And whereas if you ran a Tea Party website, they might have a Google AdSense for a gun shop. On yours, they might have an ad for a vegan restaurant, for instance. No, I mean, you know, I mean, they're going to look, you know, there's certain associations that they're going to look at, and, you know, so it's going to be relevant to your readers, and then they'll click through.
I guess that's because we don't have any advertising, I guess that's
probably. Yeah, right. I mean, yeah. You know, that's kind of the thing about running a small news site like myself, is someday I may have to depend on that as my living, just because I'm in the newspaper business, and that's diminishing, and then, like the Wicked Witch of the West underwater.
My final question would be sort of like, how do you expand your readership? I mean, how do you?
That's a big challenge for me. It really is. You know, like for instance, Mike contributes, and you know, Mike covers things that aren't really necessarily directly related to Elk Grove, but he'll go down and cover meetings down at the state capitol, and I'll put them on there because it. Because like any other editor, you sometimes need copy. You need good copy. Mike's a good writer, even though it's not directly related. But the B will see this, and Mike's stories have actually been, like on Ubinet, your stories have been placed on the B's webpage. So people see, you know, like I think your Dr. Pan's...
hearing was on Denikel.
Yeah, Denikel hearing was, you know, he wrote the story, and it was the B put it on there. Well, the B's getting free copy. I'm getting clicks through because that's going to generate more traffic for me. So there is a certain degree of cooperation that's going on. And, you know, I've been ragging on the Bee, and, you know, we all rag on everybody from time to time. The Bee is getting free labor for me, but I'm not exactly, you know, I'm getting something out of it too, because if it can bring me a couple thousand more page views a month, well, that's money in my pocket that I was already had out there that I wouldn't have had before. So I think this is, you know, I think this is one of the models that might develop over time, is that there's going to be hopefully more cooperation. The Bee needs me because they don't have a reporter down in Elk Grove. I need the Bee because they have a huge audience that can bring me traffic. So it's...
Because you have no control over who advertises on your site.
I could call up my network and say, Like, for instance, they've been running quite a few ads for UC Davis lately. I could say, you know, I don't want the UC Davis on there, and they could put the code in there. But
that's a bad campus, because of Katahi and all the controversy.
Right. No, the Med Center, I should say. Yeah, the Med Center specifically. But, you know, when they don't have any campaigns, like last few days, they had a bunch of campaigns last week for Mother's Day. Like, they had Massage Envy, and I can't remember all, so it was really pretty good. But then, like, Monday and Tuesday, they didn't have anything going, so it was just house ads. So take the good with the bad.
I'd like to close up here, because we're getting close to 9 o'clock, with the statement at the end of this article. And it was what I closed my presentation with. It was, a global network of resistance is both necessary and feasible. I think we can understand, as activists, what's necessary, you know, how it could be necessary to have a network of resistance. But how is it feasible? In other words, how do journalists report, and how do people get... How do journalists get heard? Is this a matter of a different form of organization? How do you make a livelihood? How do you organize? That was one of the things I think we missed when Rebecca Rosenblum could not show up tonight, because she's doing some of that organizing. Do you see any organizing happening amongst your fellow journalists? And what makes journalism feasible, you know, as a profession?
Wow, that's a really good question, and I've been pondering that and talking with my colleague at work. We're both owners of a business. There's 4 of us, and it's kind of like we're owners, and I don't know if that's a liability or not, but... you know, and we haven't quite figured it out yet. That's a real dilemma. And, you know, one model that's worked pretty good over the years, but it's always tenuous, is IndieBay.org. That was created out of the WTO protests. And that's where the resistance comes in. That is a worldwide network of progressive open access websites. Mm-hmm. It's not a blog, it's a website where you post on, and it's like anything the administrators classify it, but unless it's racist or really bad, then, you know, or it doesn't make any sense. There's a lot of people crazy, and you just can't post it because it just absolutely doesn't make any sense. But as long as it's coherent and has something to say, it generally gets posted, then it gets classified, but something really good, it'll be put as local, but something that's, you know, marginal might get put as other, but anybody can post. And that's kind of a more democratic thing, even than a blog, because a blog, you're subject to rules, like on Daily Cause, where I blog. You're subject to a bunch of rules, and if you don't do what they want, they kick you out. I mean, same thing on IndieBay too, in a sense, but I mean, it's pretty open, and that's just an example. That's where the resistance comes in, because Zapatistas organize their resistance starting in 1994 through email and through the early internet, and that they were the first revolution that did that, so it's very important. And the one thing that it does is that, and, you know, there's the contradiction of the corporate control, but at the same time, there's enough freedom where you can resist in a global network. And that's why, if anything we got to do, it's oppose the big restrictions that Obama and Congress want to put on the internet. I mean, to basically censor it.
And what was the name that you were talking about, the network?
At indiebay.org. IndyBay.org.
Well, one thing I would say is,
it's an international network of hundreds of, like, that's connected. In other words, if you're on one, like, you're connected to what's happening in Poland, or what's happening with Russian anarchists that are fighting against their government, and,
you know, Finland and Mexico. And
but as you say, it came out of the WTO protests in 1999.
And it still exists.
Yeah, it still exists, right?
One thing I would add is, you know, from my experience, I think the way for resistance, in my mind, you can't take on like the big, huge media groups. You have to either do something on a local basis and or a niche, like not a niche, but a particular topic. You know, I think that's what we do, because if you try to be too much in too many people, you can't compete.
And you see, Indie Bay, it's interesting, it's a worldwide network, global network, but all the websites are local and autonomous and individual, but are connected. So they're real different. Some are more anarchist, some are more anarchist, some are more Democratic Party type, and it depends, you know, but it's independent, and that's what's important. There's no advertising, no Google News on IndieBay. That's one thing I like. I don't get assaulted with a bunch of ads like I do on other sites.
Well, thanks to both of you for coming here tonight. It's really getting the journalist's view of what... Of the world, and also an economic slant to it really helps us understand what you do and what your struggles are.
Thank you.
And a really good presentation, by the way. That was that was real illuminating. You know, that's stuff that we got to get out there. I mean, the whole ratio of journalism, that's the thing that just struck me to put PR, and it just explains everything. I see guys like Steve and Vivian are just.